Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. This is Joe Cordell, and this week I think I can persuade you that you never want to leave money out and out to someone that you love.
What?
I know. Doesn't that sound
that
crazy?
That doesn't sound right.
Well, but I think if you hear me out, that over the next, how many minutes do we have, Susan?
We have 44 minutes.
44 minutes. Over the next, I think I can do it in 42 minutes. Over the next 42 minutes, I think I'm going to persuade you that you will never want to give your money out and out to someone you really care about. And this includes a lifetime gift as well as a gift at death. So we'll start out by talking about, Susan, as we should, kind of setting the stage. Mm-hmm. And the stage is, you know, as we get older, and you're my audience because you have an interest in things that as you age become more and more pressing. This is a show that's dedicated to people who are in the last third of their life. So we think a lot about, you know, what things do we want to give away while we're alive? What things do we want to transmit when we die? And I suspect the latter category is larger than the first category.
Oh, sure.
So
after I'm dead, I don't need it.
But you know, some people are thinking, well, but, you know, I don't want probate. And I get that. I don't want probate either. And I don't want probate for you either. But it's not just about probate that you want to think about sometimes gifting things before you die, or making an alternative arrangement to gift things when you're gone than have it go through a standard will. And just to clarify things, for those of you who aren't aware of this, if you listen to the show regularly, you are aware. And that's that if you have a will, one thing you're guaranteed of is probate. You know, probate's for wills. Mm-hmm. Many people think, gee, thankfully I have a will. I won't have to go through probate. But probate also, incidentally, applies to intestate succession. And that big word simply means you die without a will. So if you die without a will, yes, you go through this cumbersome process we've talked about quite a bit on the show.
We have.
Called probate. And if you have a will, you go through probate. And I don't want to demonize this process. As a matter of fact, I find myself regularly in the position of defending probate. In other words, I believe that this is an institution or a process that is essential for our society and any society, because what it does is it minimizes the risk that when you're the most vulnerable you will ever be, and I assure you when you're 6 feet under the ground, that's about as vulnerable as it gets, that somebody will not distort or defraud your purposes, that things will go to the people you want them to go to, your loved ones, and for the purposes that you intend. And also that creditors get paid before anything's handed out to beneficiaries. Surely we can agree that's a good thing, particularly those of you who are listening who are in some sort of business, mm-hmm. where you're not essentially the life insurer of all your customers, and that would be the effect if you didn't have the ability to collect from the estate when your customer dies before you've been paid. So those are worthy purposes. And let me add this too. Those of you who are going to die with small estates, meaning estates of less than, say, $50,000, I think technically now it's like $41,000, $42,000, called small estate administration. To the extent that you're going to die that, for lack of a better word, broke, then yes, it should not be a problem. There is a streamlined process by which people, your loved ones, can go and fill out a form through the clerk, the probate court, and get things rolling and wrapped up in fairly short and swift order. But I don't think I'm describing the vast majority of my audience. So that tenth of a percent, well, maybe 1%. These are the 1%ers in my audience.
On the other end, huh?
These are the 1%ers on the other end. The good news is, and you do need some good news, the good news is that your relatives will not be greatly inconvenienced when you die. Now to the other 99%. Yes, they probably will be inconvenienced. So I'm suggesting an alternative to the probate process. And I know to some of you listening, this isn't coming entirely as news. So I don't want to bore those of you who have some familiarity with this thing called trusts and have some familiarity with alternative ways of gifting, you know, beneficiary deeds, survivorship provisions, payable on death, transferable on death. I mean, many people, Susan, how often have we talked about these various vehicles?
Oh, we've talked about them on and off many times.
So I don't want to bore those of you who have some familiarity. And at the same time, I want to acknowledge that some people are not regular listeners. Some people are not sitting beside the radio 30 minutes before the show starts, watching the clock, waiting for the time to come for the show to begin every week.
You know, as fascinating as we are, I really think most people are in and out of their cars, driving to and from sporting events or catching up maybe before the game or that kind of thing.
Well, I think that might be so. In any case, so I want some of the things I say here, it will be redundant, but let me say to people who do listen regularly, you know, yeah, you'll hear some of the same things over and over, but you certainly shouldn't hear only the same things over and over. We want to introduce new ideas and new suggestions to you that you can run past your lawyer or your financial advisor, et cetera. But for those of you who have some familiarity with this basic process, bear with me. So when you create a trust, it's an alternative to a will. Mm-hmm. Now, those of you who've had estate planning, you may say, wait, I have a will in addition to a trust as part of my plan. That's called a pour-over will. And as the name implies, its purpose is simply to capture anything. It's kind of the net below somebody on a high wire, so to speak. And to the extent that you may fall or some assets were not appropriately titled to the trust, so they would otherwise go into what, you remember that probate process of intestate succession? Where you die without a will. So it's important that even when you have a trust, you got to have a will as a backup to capture anything that's not included in the trust. So, but a living trust, often called revocable trust, is by far the most common vehicle used. Now, a few of you out there have a more sophisticated, more complicated thing called an irrevocable trust. I'm not going to spend time with that in this show, at least, for those of you who are creating a trust during your lifetime that's revocable. It can become irrevocable when you die. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what you want to happen. So I'm talking about those in which you have a trust, you create a living trust. Many of you have such a thing, and maybe it'll be helpful for you to better understand why you have that during the course of this conversation. But I'm not going to talk about the more complicated irrevocable, which becomes irrevocable when you create it. So why would you bother doing that thing? And one reason, of course, and I've mentioned probate, that's one reason. And it's a pretty darn good reason if you go to the statute and look up what it's going to cost you to pay for the personal representative and the attorney to administer or to shepherd that process or your estate through the probate process. So you can do that math yourself. That's available online. Type in Missouri statutory compensation, probate, personal representative, keywords like that, and it'll bring it right up. And you can do the math and figure out what exactly you would pay through the probate process.
So your attorney wouldn't necessarily be charging you an exorbitant amount of money. These are things that are set up by statutes, by standards, and pretty much across the board, you're going to be charged the same amount depending on your estate.
Yeah, and I might say cynically, dare I suggest that lawyers might consider what is the financial impact on themselves. But dare I say, sometimes that happens, mm-hmm. And I'm being facetious here. But the point is, you know, you think of a loss leader in various industries where you have a product that is on sale and ultimately it results in additional sales. Well, by no means for all, but I'm sure there are attorneys for whom wills are a loss leader. It's something that you might charge your client $200 or $300 for, and then when the person passes away, it turns into a source of income of what could easily be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. So many people, whenever they're counting the cost of doing something alternative, whenever they're looking at paying what could easily be $2,000, $2,500 for a living trust, before they say, "Gee, I'm not going to do that if I can have a will done for $200 or $300." They need to think more fully mm-hmm. about what the total cost is going to be. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on that, though. The reason I brought this up today and the reason we're talking about how to best give your things away is not to talk about the probate process. Let's move on and talk about what I think is much more interesting and will be much more important to you. And that's, how should you give stuff to the people that you love? And many people think, well, unless there's something wrong with my children, unless they are alcoholics or drug addicts or something like that, then why would I not simply give them the assets when I die? And even those of you who are a little reluctant at that thought will think, okay, I'm comfortable with an option in which I may pay it out over three or four payments. Mm-hmm. So for many of you, you know, you think, okay, I'm going to be conservative here. I'm going to give 25% when my child's 30, maybe 25% when they're 35 and on in increments of 25% every 5 years or some variation of that. But I'm still suggesting that there is a much, much better way. Let me tell you what the implications are whenever you give money to someone. And this includes your surviving spouse. You can still give things to your surviving spouse, by the way, in a way in which they do not have full access to it, and yet, as a practical matter, will have the money that they want and need. And often, you know, the and expected surviving spouse, more often than not the wives, let me tell you statistically, whenever they hear this, immediately they're distrustful.
I was just doing the same thing, I have to say.
Yeah, well,
okay, wait a minute. Why do I have to get a gift from my husband? Because I helped get all that.
Yeah.
So tell us why we want to do that.
Well, it's easier to talk about this. We're talking about kids, but just keep in mind the same concept would apply to a surviving spouse in on a few different things. So if you leave money to your children, let's start with what implications will that have for their qualification for some sort of financial aid. Let's assume that it's grants. It could be scholarships that have a need-based component. It could be any form of financial aid relating to education.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that if you leave money to your children, your grandchildren will not qualify for those loans. Those ceilings are harsh. Mm-hmm. And many of you listening are saying amen to this, meaning that you've had this experience where you think, well, my income is very modest. My wife and I make together $60,000 a year or 70 or whatever it might be. And you're thinking, surely we're eligible. But I can tell you, if you look at the numbers and what the thresholds are for disqualification, that it's very difficult when you have any sort of inheritance, even a modest inheritance, for your kids to qualify for that sort of financial aid.
Well, if you ask any parent who's had to fill out the FAFSA form every year, and we're in that midst of that, but the amount of money that they say I can afford for college for my children is astronomical compared to what I think I can afford for college for my children.
And it's interesting that these thresholds in a variety of areas when it comes to some sort of federal or state aid are very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
Now some taxpayers, and I get it, think, well, that's the way it should be. And I understand that. But if you're planning to take care or to help your children and your grandchildren in what way you can, then you want to consider whether by giving them this money, you in effect disqualify them for financial aid that would otherwise have been available, which means in effect you've paid for education that would otherwise have been funded in some other way.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't make sense to do that. But yet I can tell you that will be the effect if you leave money out and out. It's not fixed by having it paid out in five-year increments. You still have it being in the hands and having to be listed on those financial forms. What about the possibility of bankruptcy? And let's talk about that spendthrift child, not the one who is perhaps hopelessly in the throes of poverty or alcohol, whatever the underlying cause may be of these financial woes. But I'm talking about a kid who just doesn't have very good judgment, wonderful kid in many ways, but you know that child has never been able to manage well, not in a catastrophic way. Some of you are thinking, yeah, my kid's the catastrophic one. But I want to talk to those, you know, that bell curve, those in the middle where it's very common for us, if we're truthful with ourselves, to say that we have children who some of whom may not be as good of managers as others. Why place that money in the hands of a child that you know, despite themselves, they're not going to handle it well? When you can put it, have it made available to them in a way that will meet their needs generously even, and yet have the money last for a lifetime. And I'm not, and again, I'm not assuming a huge amount of money here. Let's talk about another specter that's out there. Another reason you shouldn't simply give money out and out to the people you love. And many people realize that the divorce rate is a significant threat to marriages today, that approximately 50% is the percentage that I often hear. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably still close to accurate. These statistics are hard to get because they're kept on a state-by-state basis, and there's no central repository where we can get accurate information. So you see a little variation in that percentage. But I can tell you this, as a lawyer that with Cordell and Cordell, which before I was practicing elder law 5 years or so ago, I was, of course, practicing exclusively domestic relations, and Cordell and Cordell is a firm that's devoted exclusively to domestic relations. And I can tell you that routinely, whenever cases came up, that when the wife was the opposing party for Cordell and Cordell in the vast majority of cases, that whenever the wife had a gift or an inheritance from her parents, mm-hmm. that more likely than not, we were going to persuade a court that that's a marital asset, because it's just very difficult to take an asset that you leave for your children and have them be so punctilious about how they manage it that they keep it separate character. It's true that something that is given as a gift to a child individually and not to the child and their spouse is technically a separate asset at that point. Mm-hmm. But it can be easily converted through commingling, for example. It can easily be converted into a marital asset. And in the vast majority of cases, some part is.
So if you ever... make sure that we understand this. So let's say the gift is given to the daughter and they end up using it together for something, just for one purchase. That suddenly makes it more of a marital property. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, they can take it and they can buy an asset that is in the name of both parties. Yes, that will become marital then. But, you know, you can commingle. You can simply take money that's clearly marital money and deposit it in the same account, and over time that will become hopelessly commingled. And many people naively believe, for example, that the income that they earn from their paycheck is a separate asset, and that's a reasonable assumption. It's just that the law is often not reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And if, for example, you leave $200,000 to your daughter, and your daughter has a job, and she's earning a couple thousand dollars a month, and she's taking part of that and depositing it in her savings, which includes this $200,000. Her entire paycheck is a marital asset, just like her spouse's is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's earnings that occurred during the course of the marriage. Similar thing is that the earnings on a separate asset will be considered marital. So you can see how the pitfalls are such that it'd be very difficult to not misstep whenever you're trying to maintain the separate character, even for a lawyer who's policing it. So you can imagine the average 20-something or 30-something or 40-something. And I want people to be aware that when they simply leave money to their children, they're probably leaving money in effect to their children and their child's spouse. And I can tell you that when I think about things that would bother me, I have two daughters in college now, but when I think about things that would bother me, I can't think of many things that bother me more than the idea of the person that I probably like least on this planet, the man who had divorced my daughter, getting half of what my wife and I had worked for. So this is just another reason why you should think about, is there a better way than simply putting in your trust or your will that at my death, I want this money distributed, checks written? But I'm telling you, the vast majority of wills and trusts are worded that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you have a trust doesn't mean that you do what I'm suggesting. I mean, you could have a trust, you avoid probate, and then the day after, or a week or a month after the death of you, then you have someone, the trustee, who pulls out a checkbook and is writing checks and distributing money, all of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that could very well be the terms of a trust. And I would argue that many times that is the term of a trust.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a lawyer who's alerting you to the fact that, wait, there's a better way. Don't simply disperse these funds in that way. Let's let your children enjoy them over a lifetime and have your grandchildren be able to take advantage of wonderful programs that will allow them to go to better colleges and to go to for more years of college than they otherwise would. If you have a child that has a special need, and those of you who are thinking, no, I don't, but wait, you don't now.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a child that has a special need at some point, or a grandchild rather, then in either case, if you leave this money to them, I'm telling you, they will not qualify in all likelihood for these benefits that would otherwise be available on a state and federal level. Similar thing with Medicaid. Your children, depending on how old they are, your mm-hmm. children may be at a point where your grandkids are adults and your kids may be looking at some form of long-term care before long. Medicaid, in order to qualify for it, I can assure you that however much money you leave, assuming it's over $999, now I think in Missouri it's gone up to $3,000. But the point is, however much you leave, we'll disqualify them.
Wow.
So these are just a few of the reasons that there's a much, much better way for you to allow your children to have tremendous benefits of what you've worked for over your lifetime without having them live with the risk and the hardships that might come from leaving them a significant amount of money.
And I think that's what all parents want to do. I mean, I think it's not the money per se. I think it's what the money represents. We want to leave our kids security. We want to leave them better off than we were. We want to give them opportunities that maybe we never had. And the most common thing that we think about is, well, I'll just give it to them because I don't need it anymore. But you're suggesting that there is a better way to do this, one that will last them longer throughout their life and maybe even benefit the next generation.
Yeah, among other things. So let's do this, Susan. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back for a minute, and I'll talk more about how this is accomplished, and I'll talk a little bit how it can benefit a surviving spouse. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, we're back. Now let's talk about how you accomplish this. I've made the argument that it's best to not simply hand money out in full to the people you love when you pass, or while you're alive, incidentally. Everything I've just said would apply to a lifetime gift as well. Well, you can set this up in, if we imagine a continuum or like a rheostat, you know, you can pull along this line, you choose exactly how much of something you want, mm-hmm. whether you want it to have full power or just a very little bit. That sort of continuum is the way to think about the amount of control you can give the people you love. And that's one of the marvelous things about a trust is, number one, we don't have to be talking about a lot of money. Those of you who are thinking, oh, gee, this is a show where he's talking to these rich clients. No, our clients are middle-class clients. And those of you who listen to the show regularly know that.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, our clients are people who definitely don't have tax issues when they die in terms of estate tax, which now the exemption is so high that you have to be wealthy before those issues come up. But most of the clients of elder law practitioners are people who are middle class and are concerned about how do I effectively transfer the things that I've worked for to the people I love? How do I qualify for long-term care? How will my children and grandchildren qualify for the benefits that they might need, et cetera? So this is largely a middle-class crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a crisis for the poor because they will qualify, and it's not a crisis for the wealthy because they don't need to qualify.
Mm-hmm.
So,
these are the people that have gone to work every day, paid their taxes, raised their kids, paid off their house, done all of those things, and they just want to give the next generation the fruits of their labor.
Yeah. It's a very modest and humble expectation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so easy to do.
Right.
It's not so easy to do now. So whenever we're talking about the importance of keeping something in a trust and not simply writing those checks within a week or so after you pass, then you need to know how broad the flexibility is. For example, if you have a child that you do have some of those concerns about, It's whether they're very extreme concerns, if they have had a history maybe of drug or alcohol abuse. I'm sure that we have some people listening who've had children that have had that. Then in that case, you would probably name a trustee in which the child would not be a co-trustee, nor perhaps could they even fire the trustee. So you can choose how much influence or power that your beneficiary may have. Mm-hmm. So on the one extreme would be that scenario where you want to protect the child from themselves. And that's what some people automatically assume is the case when you have a trust, is that you have this dictatorial trustee, mm-hmm. you know, who's ruling your life with this Spartan payment every month. But that is only the case if your loved one, your ancestor, whoever may have created such a trust, felt that it was necessary and appropriate. But there's no reason that a trust has to be that. Let's imagine the other end of the spectrum. So one is the harsh, authoritative end in which you want to be sure that the beneficiary doesn't have any influence over the trust. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who need that, the good news, of course, that's there. But what about what I think is more people who are thinking about the other end of the spectrum? How far can I go in terms of allowing the people I love to have fairly liberal access? And your concern is not that these that I mentioned a moment ago, but you still want to for them to have the protection and the benefit of the trust. Well, you could, for example, allow your child to be a co-trustee. You can't allow your child, who I'm assuming is the beneficiary, you can't allow your child to be just the only co-trustee as well as a beneficiary, because that's a problem in order to get the asset protection that we've just talked about.
Okay.
So in order to have that asset not show up on financial forms, to not be vulnerable to lawsuits, divorce, financial aid qualification, long-term care qualification, in order for those things to be effective, you cannot have your child as the only trustee and the only beneficiary.
Okay.
So you need a co-trustee.
So they can be a trustee with someone else and the beneficiary, but there have to be at least two trustees in that case.
Yes.
Okay.
And it can get better than that. You can give your child the ability to fire the co-trustee. So that means that effectively your child can be to a great extent in control.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there has to be some meaningful constraints. And I want to emphasize this to those of you who are listening. If a lawyer, or certainly anyone that's not a lawyer, tells you that the law is something in which it sounds like a free lunch, I won't say that it's impossible that's true. I'm sure we've had such laws. But for the most part, the laws that have been around for a long time, and believe me, trust law, probate law, wills have been around among the longest, mm-hmm. hundreds of years. I mean, there aren't free lunches. So if you want to enjoy some of the benefits that I mentioned a while ago, you should have an expectation that there must be some limitation, some concession, some constraint. But the good news is it's not a great constraint.
Mm-hmm.
But the constraint is that you need someone else who has authority too, if we're going to do the co-trustee route, that is meaningful. But it still would not preclude your loved one who is a co-trustee from firing their co-trustee and hiring someone new. But they have to hire someone new. And I don't think you need to go to law school to appreciate this point. In order for you to have the protections from a creditor or an ex-spouse that's bringing a lawsuit and alleging that your child really does have access to this money, if that were just a thinly veiled legal mechanism, then it would come crashing down. It would be mm-hmm. pierced is the word. Mm-hmm. It would be pierced because the court would say, the child has complete control. No, we're not going to allow you to hide behind this sham entity.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that for asset protection purposes, trusts do provide meaningful protection is that there have to be meaningful constraints. And a co-trustee is a meaningful constraint.
So could you have each of your children, if you had two kids, could you have them be co-trustees?
You could. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's what commonly happens.
Okay.
Let's assume you have two kids, Tim and Sue. So Tim and Sue will be each other's co-trustees on their two trusts. They'll each have a trust, and they'll each be the other's co-trustee. And yeah, you're not shackling your children together, which is, I think, an invitation to conflict.
I was going to say, can I fire my brother?
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how sometimes sometimes partnerships work best when each partner knows that there's an exit.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
And I think that I can tell you from experience that among the times we've done this with our clients, that whenever you have siblings, I think almost whenever I say the word sibling, I want to say the word rivalry, because you tend to think of a potential conflict, but I've never seen it happen where there's been a firing of a coach or a sibling so far. But the whole idea is they both know that, of course, they can fire their mm-hmm. sibling. And so they each cooperate. Now, what I've just described to you, some of the listeners have figured out already, that if these kids wanted to conspire and essentially withdraw everything from their trust, they could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So what I just described to you, remember, this is the other end of the continuum.
Right.
We talked about the opposite end. The opposite end is don't worry about it. It'll never happen. So for those of you who are thinking, I don't want them to have that much capability, good. There's a solution for you. And as a matter of fact, a much better tried and more hoary traditions associated with that end of the spectrum than this end. This end is what you're seeing more often today. And that's where people want to confer benefits, but they don't want to straitjacket their loved ones. Their motivation is not that they think their loved one is this, you know, derelict or this mm-hmm. Prodigal son. Instead, they think, you know, there are so many potential benefits to doing this, so many sources of support, security from all these lawsuits that are around every corner today where you have a car accident, you lose everything you have.
Mm-hmm.
Your child has a car accident in your car, and it's negligent entrustment action, and you can lose everything you have.
Mm-hmm.
The world we live in is so fraught with financial risk, and the idea that you can leave your legacy to your children, not simply in the form of a check that comes attached to it, all the risks and threats that I've described and many more, but instead you deliver to them in this wonderful Teflon container,
mm-hmm.
this container that they couldn't have created themselves. It was created by a third party for them, which makes it all the more effective. It's called a third party trust, meaning they didn't create it for themselves. Again, you did it. You did it because you wanted to confer wonderful asset protection benefits on your children and your grandchildren. Now back to the spectrum. So on the end that we're talking about here, where it's liberal, where you've structured it in such a way to where, as a practical matter, they can reach in and take out, with their co-trustee's permission, what they want when they want it. This only works if you've successfully communicated to your children how wonderful this form that they've received this gift is, and that they don't want to screw it up. They don't want to take money out before they need it. Because the moment that money comes out, then we're talking about those risks we were talking about mm-hmm. a while ago. So, but I think a child who, again, we're assuming children who are reasonable here, these are the ones where the parents are saying, yeah, this child, great judgment. You know, he or she has always been very level-headed. This is the one that you can say to them before you die, and you must, incidentally,
mm-hmm.
meaning they will not figure this out on their own. You need to sit them down if you've created such a wonderful trust for them and say to them, what I'm giving you is marvelous. It's a precious thing. Don't screw it up. You know, take out money only as you need it for those things that you need. And for example, if you want to buy a condo, if you and your husband want to buy a condo in Florida, then suggest to your daughter, buy that in the trust. The trust will own it.
Okay.
And then if anything happens, heaven forbid, of course, but if he gets to Florida and finds that he has a lot in common with the lady working in the 19th hole. Some people don't know what that is. That's the bar at the golf course.
The bar at the end of the day.
So if he meets such a person, then this condo that you've bought is not a marital asset. You bought it with the separate funds that you left in your trust because you didn't need the money for anything in particular.
Okay, that's a point I don't think we've stressed a lot, is that the trust can actually own the asset, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so that's something I guess I don't know that I had ever made that connection before, is that I always thought, okay, we pull the money out, but this is still yet another way that the asset is protected. So the trust owns the extra condo or something like that.
Yeah. And I should make that clear, is that, and this is sometimes it's a sensitive issue, is your child that you leave, say, So you have two children, you leave $300,000 to each of them. Well, and I get it from a marital standpoint. You would like to see perhaps your daughter choose to buy the marital home with the money that is in the trust and buy it in the trust. Mm-hmm. But I get it. It's a sensitive thing. The husband is entitled to feel a little uneasy with the fact their marital home is something he doesn't own.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that. There's room for negotiating that. Mm-hmm. It's less important the specific way that questions like that are resolved than it is that they be resolved by your daughter with an eye to the implications for the things that we've talked about. As long as she is considering those factors and arriving at what she thinks is the best decision under those circumstances, then you're far ahead. Far ahead as if you'd written a check.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever this trust is created, the whole idea is that money will only be taken out as it's needed. And I'm willing to bet, and I've prepared my clients for this, that they need to have a provision for this to be a dynasty trust. A dynasty trust is permitted in the state of Missouri. It means that a trust can go on for more than one generation, for multiple generations.
Okay.
And you don't have to be rich to think in terms of that possibility. Those of you who think that it's unlikely that if you left $300,000 to your daughter, that there would be a nickel of it left by the time she died, think about this. How many of you would have bet that when you started saving for your 401ks or your IRAs when you were 35 years old, how many of you would have bet if I'd asked you when you were 35 whether you would use that money before you died? How many of you would have said, no, I won't. My goal is to not spend this and leave it for another generation. That was the farthest thing from people's minds. I mean, their goal was, gee, if I can avoid taxation and let this accumulate for 30 years, I'll be delighted to pull it out. And if you'd said to them then, but you know, I'm going to have to pay taxes then, well, that's fine, but look at the huge benefit I got. Mm-hmm. 30 years of accrual of earnings without taxes. And so, yeah, when I pull it out when I'm 65, 70, 75, I'll pay taxes. But it's funny, that isn't what happens.
Right.
Instead, people want to leave it in there so they die with money, except for the RMDs, required minimum distributions. But beyond that, I'm telling you that I don't know what to venture. The experience with my clients, probably a third die with money that are in their IRAs or 401ks, because
really,
that's what they want to do.
Hmm.
So allow for the possibility that because you have this marvelous container, that your daughter or your son or your children will choose to leave money in there that will continue on under very similar terms and conditions for their children. And because you have that possibility, you need to make provision in your trust for it to become effective for additional generations. Very easy to do. And then you just have the trust in when the money has become so little that there's not administrative efficiency or justification for continuing it. So that way you define a conclusion to the trust that you don't have to wait until the last nickel is spent.
Until everything is gone.
Yeah.
Is there any benefit to naming a grandchild or the next generation as a trustee or setting aside something specific for them? I mean, I know some people have tried to set aside education trusts or they want to help fund that education. We've talked a little bit about how having the trust helps them qualify for benefits. But what if the grandparents just say, I want to help fund that?
Well, there are a couple schools of thought on that. I mean, a lot of people, maybe I'd say the majority position that what I see among my clients who we talk about these issues a lot is that they figure, well, I'll go ahead and leave it in the hands of my children to do that. So they'll go ahead and leave money to their children and let them choose to create such a pot or a fund, et cetera. There are a couple of problems with that. One is it will only start accumulating after you've passed if you don't go ahead and divide it up now. So in other words, it'll continue to be in a common fund because it'll be in a revocable trust that let's assume two clients age 75 years old create a trust, husband, wife, and they have a couple kids and they have some grandkids. So if they create a revocable trust and they assume that their kids' education will be taken care of by their children, then that money will not be enjoying any tax benefits, et cetera, until after they've passed. But there is this notion, I see this a lot with clients, is that they hate to take money that would otherwise be in the hands of their children, that their children might need for some purpose, and go ahead and earmark it or silo it for another purpose. But I tend to think that where you have enough money, and I'm not assuming rich here, where most of my clients are going to be leaving less than $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who are leaving say $500,000 behind or $400,000, including the value of their home, et cetera, this is everything,
mm-hmm.
life insurance too. For those people, it might very well make sense to take some segment of it and create a subtrust. A subtrust means rather than simply listing your children as the beneficiaries, which is a common provision in a trust,
mm-hmm.
so you create a trust in which it's revocable. So the 75-year-old couple will use things freely while they're alive. And they're, you remember, what's cool about this is until you're incompetent, you can do anything you want with this trust.
Right.
You've not created something that you can't undo.
Right.
But during that time, if you want to reserve assets specifically for those kids, you can go ahead and create a subtrust within the trust that is specifically for them, but it will silo a segment of the money that will be for those kids, and it'll operate according to its own rules. You can choose as a trustee for that, perhaps one of your children.
Okay.
But again, I think I'd be careful about that if it might potentially impact their qualification. If they're a minor,
mm-hmm.
then yeah, it would impact it. So I probably wouldn't use the children alone. I would have the co-trustee we mentioned a while ago at least.
Okay.
If not simply a separate trustee. But you can create a separate fund for those kids. I like that better than for example, the plans where you can make a tax-free contribution or at least money. Generally, the contributions are not tax-free, but they're money that accumulates over time, and the accumulations are not taxed as they accumulate.
How is it affected if the kids decide not to go to college? If you've set aside money and earmarked it for advanced education, what happens if that student decides not to go to college? What happens to the money? Or I guess, do you write the trust so that is covered or what?
Yeah, well, most of the provisions, and I think this is especially more common today. Now many people are starting to realize that this automatic decision or this goal that every child goes to college is turning out not to be a particularly wise choice for some kids. There are lots of career options now that don't require a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
So trade schools, definitions that are very, very broad are generally incorporated. And then finally, for the child that doesn't meet any of those definitions, however broad, generally what clients will do is at some point the funds will be made available.
Okay.
And again, we're assuming not a pot of money here. So I'm
right.
okay with that.
Right.
If it's a relatively lower amount of money, I'm okay with it, despite everything I've said today. But yeah, you want to have a definition that's very broad and give a child a chance to go to vocational school. I mean, think about the employment opportunities for a plumber or an electrician or all
mm-hmm.
these trades now where we all have had the experience that we can't get anybody who knows how to do these things
mm-hmm.
today because they all think they're supposed to go to college.
Exactly.
Anyway, so how much time do we have left?
We have about 2 minutes left. Any closing thoughts? I do have one more question, though.
Go ahead.
All right. So really quickly, what if I want to set aside money for, say, trips? Say my family has done family trips every year at Christmas or the holidays or something along like that. And I really would love to see those continue. Can I set that up in my trust and put some specifications of every year I want you to go back to North Carolina and go to the Outer Banks or wherever it is you would like to go?
You could do that. Now, some people call that ruling from the grave. Now there's, you know, this is a very much a judgment call to at what point in what I've said, for example, is not that and going to that is. So it's all a matter of perspective. But I will tell you that it is very common, like with vacation properties. And there's actually been a lot of litigation over it where a trust is created over this cabin at Outer Banks, for example. And that's more commonly the case. It's not that I want you to have money to go visit this place. They want you to go to a certain place.
Okay.
You know, it's tied to a specific property often. So when you read these cases, you've got to have an exit strategy where all the beneficiaries can agree to sell it.
Okay.
Some means of divesting. Boy, we're out of time. So we've covered a lot of material here. I hope it was helpful to you. Next week, we'll pick up with some further discussions about how to avoid legal forms versus having true lawyer creative work, the kind of stuff you're paying a lot of money for. Till then, have a wonderful week.